Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 11th episode of What's Wrong with the Podcast. Today, we have the pleasure of talking to Aaron Feldman. Aaron is the co-founder and managing member of Benchmark Real Estate Group in New York City. He has been actively investing in and managing residential real estate in New York City since 2004. Benchmark Real Estate Group is a real estate investment and management firm specializing in the acquisition and repositioning of New York City multifamily assets. Their initiatives are directed towards growing and developing neighborhoods with an awareness of environmental and social responsibility. Aaron, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So please tell me a bit about yourself. What's your story and what's the background of your firm?
Absolutely. So I am the co-founder of a firm called Benchmark Real Estate Group, which specializes in the acquisition and redevelopment of apartment buildings in New York City. I started the firm in 2009 after having 6 years of experience working at a similar type of platform. In the last 15 years, all of which have been living in New York City, greatest city in the world, but not without challenges. And I think the goal for Benchmark, as we invest in different communities around New York City, is to really use the community to drive, you know, our business plans. And when we're renovating apartments, we're not just focused on the one building. We're also looking to the neighborhood to try and figure out, are there ways to improve the streetscapes? Are there community parks? We work very closely with a handful of nonprofits, specifically Grow NYC, Restoration New York. So there have been very many ways for us to connect with our neighbors, if you will, while we're running, you know, a for-profit investment business. We try and do both. It's very important to us, you know, that we improve the neighborhoods that we're investing in, not just for our tenants, but for the neighborhood as a whole.
Well, I love hearing this, especially because, you know, it's such a real estate driven city, New York City. And as fascinating as it is, I think it's also facing a lot of challenges within built environment and maybe not directly visible or perceivable to visitors or tourists. But I think residents over time are seeing a lot of shift, whether that is, you know, gentrification or decrease of lack of public spaces, or whether that's accessibility issues. What is missing? Like, why are these not addressed all around throughout the industry? And there are so many real estate companies out there, but I feel like there's so few like you. And what are the main problems you're seeing and why these are happening?
Sure. There are a couple of questions. I'll start with the fundamental issue as I see it, which is the evolution of function is a difficult thing to predict. And because of it, you're finding that real estate can be obsolete, or it can be obsolete within a particular set of laws which govern the use of real estate, whether it's zoning or any other policy that dictates how you can utilize a building, depending on which neighborhood that you're in, depending on density, depending on a lot of things, right? So I would say that, you know, when it comes to the future, our collective imagination, not just in New York City, but around the world, it seems to fail us. You know, we don't really know what to expect. I think, you know, you mentioned, you know, like community space, or, you know, looking at New York from a socioeconomic perspective, of which, of course, we've seen sharp increases in, you know, socioeconomic and spatial inequalities, the rise of homelessness, right? So you're having to address affordability, which is a big issue, you know, in New York City. You know, one that we're well aware of, but you're also having to understand what it means to work within the political environment, you know, which is, you know, awfully kind of charged today, and rightfully so. There's a lot of passion, there are a lot of ideas, and I think from my perspective, you know, it all starts with, you know, the evolution of function. I would say New York City, you know, just when you're looking at the streetscapes, and you could divide it between uptown and downtown, but we have done a pretty good job understanding the importance of, you know, community-oriented facilities, convenience space, space that makes it easy to switch between work and non-work. You're seeing the city require developers to build more kind of park-like space. Downtown has less of it. Of course, we have Central Park uptown. Prospect Park is beautiful in Brooklyn. So there are opportunities different in, say, cities like Tokyo, of which 5% of the city is devoted to parks, or London, of which, you know, 30%. That's a huge number. And it's why so many people, you know, enjoy living there, whether they recognize it or not. And so there certainly are examples out there of things I think that we could incorporate as a city, but it's tough. We have a very old infrastructure. And I think, again, the function of that infrastructure continues to evolve. And so it's just a balance between the policy, which governs what you can do with it, and then, of course, the cost to actually, you know, change. It's interesting. It's complicated.
And you touched upon a good point. Like, I think so many things in real estate is driven by policy or local regulations, whereas we all know policy also typically lags, right? Like, if the technology industry relied on policy, then we wouldn't be where we are at with all the, you know, technological advancements that we have today in the 21st century. But at the same time, like, for example, in one of our like past episodes, we discussed about Highline, how even though it was a public space, it actually caused huge gentrification in the neighborhood. And therefore, was it a good project? And my opinion is that, you know, Highline is a great project. It's not Highline's fault that this was not planned well, right? And I also, it's also hard to just like point finger at developers where as a business, how do you like, you know, maximize profit? Or like that is generally, maybe it shouldn't be, but it's generally the concern as real estate development is also driven by finance world. And if this, like if city came into place or if there were more policies to make the neighborhood more diverse, if people just couldn't like build high-end condos all around, then it wouldn't be where it is today, right? So I think there's so much like influence of the city in general on how the neighborhoods develop and shift over time. I mean, we see this like you mentioned, if there are incentives through the city on like incorporating public plazas or more open spaces, like then we actually see developments incorporating those. So there's so much dependence on policy and I guess economic incentives and also finance and banking, right? Like your project is defined as the budget you can get from whether investors or the bank. So it's a very complex group to work within, right? And it's really hard to realize something that you know may be best for the local neighborhood, but can you actually realize it? And I would love to hear your opinion on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's why, and by the way, I think you hit on the singular most important word that defines New York City, which is diversity. And I think that's the beauty of what New York City is. And I think it has a lot to do with how dense of a city New York City is, because I think the communities that are built around density, right, often overlap others. And so people have common interests that aren't necessarily within their community, but it can be very close by. And I think that's where you see neighborhood restaurants, neighborhood cafes. And, you know, it's a beautiful thing that has been challenged socioeconomically. But for that, I would say politically, it gets frustrating, right? I think you want your politicians to provide direction, right? Right. You want them to have ideas. The solutions take time. And fortunately, there's a huge amount of public funding going into public-private ventures, public ventures, but improving New York City. But too many times, I think you hear things like, you know, the goals are often very vague or overgeneralized, like promote better living or vitalize the city, right? To which no one objects, but it's like, what does it even mean, right? And so you're not able to kind of fix anything or kind of chart a clear path, which the private sector can kind of get on board with, because it does really require both. And you are seeing it with the city's made a commitment towards bringing more electric buses into the fleet, or they've, you know, committed to improving the airports, right? Making sure that the transportation and the kind of hubs and the commute improves, because that's a part of everyone's quality of life, whether you're visiting or you live here. But I think kind of nurturing the cultural importance, which has always been so vital to New York City's standing in the world, you know, is a delicate balance of, you know, what's, because you said the private sector is going to try and make money based on what is allowable under the current law.
Yeah. However much they can make, right? Because then if they do not hit the max that they can actually realize, then it's almost like perceived as a failed business or a failed project.
Right. So you have skewed priorities. And I think, again, the role of government and politics, everything that we would ever talk about, right, for the most part, you know, even if it's design oriented, right, even if I'm going into one of my buildings, you know, and I'm talking about the layout of an apartment, you know, I, of course, you know, want to be sensitive to the ADA requirements, but it's also law, right? And there's certain things that I have to do, and I have to build a bathroom that's a certain size, and the building has to be accessible. And that's part of what's required of me, right, by the city and state of New York. So, you know, you do work within a set of rules, but I think, again, the process needs to be more collaborative. We could spend a whole long time, and you know, discussing some of the issues around housing law or building code. But I would describe this, you just need strong leadership. It needs to be less biased and less partisan if we're going to fix you know, these are long-term issues, right? This isn't something you're going to fix in the next, you know, 3 to 5 years of somebody's term in office, which is why I don't think anyone expects too much change from politicians today. So it's far from an easy job. I don't want to suggest that I have all the answers. I certainly don't. But I think you need to synthesize and you need to strike a balance between what have we always valued as a city and then what does that mean going forward? Because everything needs to be thoughtful, whether it's, you know, environmental impact, whether it's adding more density to accommodate more affordable housing, you know, and anything else that obviously comes up in this form.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, you touched upon like a few points that is really, really crucial. I think, like, first of all, you mentioned, you know, diversity in New York City is also one of the biggest attractions of New York City, right? Like, people love to be here or people love to visit here because it's such a melting pot. And then we see, because of how unaffordable it starts to get, it's just becoming a little bit standardized. You see, like, these old, like, almost historic delis or shop being replaced by big chains or just air, like, you start seeing less diversity in neighborhoods. And also, I think that is something to be very, very mindful of. Like, this is one of the most attractive cities in the world. Like, how do we not lose that? And also, there's, like you said, the environmental aspect where we're already surrounded by so many old buildings. And when the drive is to just make profit with new developments and sustainability is not of a concern, like, this is going to be a city that is very far behind in the global agenda. Like, Europe is talking about having building passports in order, like, pushing transparency in building materials so that the renters or buyers can make a more educated decision on where they're locating. I think that when the world is going there and, like, New York is still getting away with just developing and making money and relying on people just wanting to be close to transportation or just want to be in New York in general, that doesn't seem sustainable or in the long run, it's going to hurt New York, I feel like.
I think what you've described very well is, what's our value system, right? We've lived in a city for a very long time that values, you know, the preservation of old buildings. And by the way, I don't necessarily disagree with that. I grew up in Charleston, South Carolina. I lived there 18 years. I went to New Orleans to study. And, you know, both cities have this cultural richness that comes from this building stock that's kind of very old and very charming and very unique from an architectural and a historical perspective. And I think that is important up until the point where there are other things that you value more, whether it's the environmental impact, the efficiency of a building, the efficiency of its systems. Of course, we've discussed the use of a specific building and the adaptability of real estate, which can be easy or hard depending on what it is. And so I think, again, you're going to have to answer some very difficult questions. Maybe it's having historic districts, but everything in a certain neighborhood, you know, that needs to come down just comes down. And you're kind of, again, this is not something that I figured out, but culturally, we're accepting of the fact that, you know, New York City is going to be noisy. Periods throughout the day where you're maybe not getting as much sunshine. You're going to walk down the street and you better watch where you're going because there's a lot of other people that are kind of hustling between points of nation. The other thing I would say is it has to be a place, New York City, where people continue to come to dream. I think that New York, unlike any city in the world, has been the place where passion kind of run wild, right? You find in New York, there are so many people with creative minds. Once you come here with an idea, it evolves. right? It's still the most unique playground, I think, for new ideas. And so, yeah, we have some challenges and we have some things we need to kind of figure out, but we have a wonderful, resource, which is the people. And so I still remain optimistic that, you know, with the right policy, right, we will kind of leverage the ideas and hopefully come up with the right solutions. But it's definitely, and for a guy like me who didn't grow up here, and I think this is true for most people who move to New York, is you're hopeful that there is a bright future. And if you're going to accomplish something great, New York City provides the opportunity, to do it. And so the settlers, whether they're from, you know, Charleston, South Carolina, like myself, or they're from, you know, anywhere else in the world, I still think you're finding, you know, people that are showing up, that are super ambitious and ready to participate in whatever evolution needs to occur.
Okay, so we know if we solely relied on policy, things are going to take forever, right? And this is a very like multidisciplinary, like complex team that you also need to play with in order to realize any project, whether in New York City or anywhere else. Like real estate in general, so many parties involved. What are some collaborative efforts that can be done within the playing field without waiting around for policy? And I want you to sort of walk us through the process of what you do as well, as you touch base with the communities, which is a huge part in like any inclusive effort to like, before you're even like get into the project, while you're planning, like engaging the local community is super important and often missed out on. Which is why we see either these like out of scale buildings that sort of, even look scary for the neighborhood, or we see these like really nice buildings that are like 80% vacant and become ghost towers at night just because it's like filled out by investors. So the locals really do not like those towers. So can you walk me through a little bit of your process and what you're trying to do with what you have already presented to you as regulations?
Yeah. So let's talk about like real life stuff. So I would say that the one, like the most challenging, disappointing issue that's come from the last kind of cycle, if you will, in real estate, as things got expensive and investors came in, and, you know, you've seen that kind of natural pricing adjustment, which resulted in a lot of the retail turning over. You've also seen structural shifts in kind of the retail environment, whether it's internet shopping, or just consumption habits, right? So you have department stores that are going away. I mean, Barney's is going out of business. That's a very difficult thing culturally to deal with as a New Yorker, as someone who, you know, it is that kind of incubator for this neighborhood. And I, by the way, I understand we have far more problems in the city than Barney's going out of business, but I think it's representative of just like evolution of function as we started off. So I would say that the lack of like streetscape, right, which has been a challenging issue. And I think the politicians are now trying to, you know, think through some type of, you know, rent control, which again, I don't think is necessary. I think the market will just adjust. It's ironic that you're now seeing restaurants come back to Madison Avenue, for example, where it was too expensive for so long. But I think things reset. And I think that people with good ideas, right, retail's become more experiential, right? So I think, as I said before, the function of that space, right, it's less about utility, right? It was once, where do I go to get bread? It's not that anymore. Now it's social exchange or entertainment. And so the function of all of that space, you know, continues to evolve, and it has to do so in this new environment, which includes the internet, right? And includes different taste profiles. And so this is a short-term issue. You're going to see the retail fill back in. Now, I would suggest that New York City has too much retail just in general. I think we have something like a data point I read not too long ago is that we have 20 times the amount of retail square footage per capita as London. And so you could make the argument that, you know, we just built too much of it. But guess what? I can't go convert a retail store into an apartment. The city won't allow me to do it. And that's where policy comes into play. And so certainly we could sit down with our architects. We could draw a very nice apartment with legal egress. You know, everything's built the way it needs to be built in order to be. But they need to look at the certificate of occupancy, and they're going to have to determine whether or not they're going to allow us to execute a different use. And if they say no, we're out of luck. And so I think we're having to kind of be thoughtful about what's what, because right now, sure, there's a tremendous amount of vacant retail. It makes the city less interesting, and that's not good for anyone. It's not good for the developers who invested in the real estate. And it gets complex, like the way the deals are structured may prevent somebody from renting something this minute. So there are some unique examples, but it's not all that headline news, which is the landlords are just independently deciding to keep the city, you know, in this kind of perpetual state of vacancy. Like that does no one any good.
Also think like it's not only just developers or landlords' responsibility. I feel like, and this is one of the reasons why we started What's Wrong With. I feel like, you know, the architecture and design profession itself is also in crisis. I think architects need to expose themselves to other industries and stakeholders more and more to understand and realize better spaces and work with the landlords in collaboration to sort of realize those sites. And this is like, of course, as you said, still very driven by policy. Like if we propose a hybrid use, is it going to be approved? We don't know. But still, like there could have been a much more collaborative way of sort of addressing these things.
I agree with you. I mean, I think generally we're in somewhat of an antiquated industry, right? Like real estate is slow to kind of adjust. And you've seen certainly, you know, that's changed a lot, whether it's building materials, you know, whether it's kind of environmental impact. I read a book recently by a really, really, I think, you know, brilliant woman named Pauline Brown. It's called, I think it's called Aesthetic Intelligence. Her book is about the concept of aesthetic intelligence, which is, you know, the way that products kind of look and feel, the way that they adapt to their environment. It can be something commodity-like, right? Like coffee, she uses the example of Starbucks, where, you know, what was very innovative was the lifestyle brand they built around one of the most commoditized products in the world, which is the coffee bean. And of course, they created all this pricing power, right, around that experience. And you can apply the same idea to, you know, LaGuardia Airport's renovation, right? Like somebody's choosing a tile that's going on the floor. Somebody's choosing a paint color, right? It used to be that hospitals and airports were just the most just uninspired, you know, kind of depressing design you've ever seen. But today people are being more thoughtful about the way things look and feel. And by the way, LaGuardia, what's been renovated looks beautiful. It's a place you can comfortably spend some time, right? Which is enhancing the way that our city, you know, lives. And that's a great thing. I would say practically, kind of back to my portfolio and my business, as it relates to affordability, we've over the years tried to understand, you know, living dynamics in different neighborhoods and have found that, you know, there are some neighborhoods like the East Village, for example, where the audience is going to skew a little bit younger. People are interested in sharing apartments, even if it's tight, right? So you've taken, or we've taken, you know, one bedroom apartments and converted them to two bedrooms, maybe even three bedrooms, depending on the light, air, the layout, you know, whatever. And that, by definition, increases the affordability because you've taken an apartment suitable for one person and you've now made it suitable for three, and it's not three times as expensive. And so you're making real estate more affordable. Now, one of the challenges sometimes is, of course, the layout. And the city requires that in order to have a legal bedroom, it needs to be 8 feet by 8 feet and have legal light and air. Okay, that's fine. But why? Why is it 8 by 8? Why is it not 8 by 7? Why is it not 8 by 6? Why does the legal light and air need to be a window that's X size? So I think we need to continue rethinking a lot of the laws, right, rules that are in place that could be tinkered with in order to push something that's higher up on our value chain. We certainly don't want to compromise safety, right? You don't want to be in that position where, you know, God forbid, you know, there's an emergency in the building and someone, you know, can't get to safety. Of course not, right? But if you're telling me that I can build a bed, right, that's a bit more functional today because furniture is, you know, just more creative. It's modular. There are things you could do with it today that you couldn't do, you know, many years ago when this code was written, right? Someone can live comfortably and safely in a bedroom that's smaller than what we can legally build. Well, why shouldn't we be able to build it? Because it's going to make it more affordable. And so again, I just go back to what's our value system? You know, what do we want to do? And the fact that, you know, we kind of are relying on the government to, you know, create, you know, these plans, this direction, you know, I'm with you. We should be having these conversations. I'm not sure what the appropriate forum is, but we're in front of our kind of Department of Buildings reps and Housing Preservation Department. And, you know, we may mention these things casually. And listen, you have a lot of hardworking people who are doing the best they can. I think it's just a very difficult time. And there's just an enormous amount of work to do. And I think a lot of frustration comes from just the process procedures the city has in place. But again, not any one individual's fault. And I certainly don't have all the answers or any of like the specific answers. But I think, again, right now we're in just idea phase. And I think the next step is, you know, charting a specific course, right? Not just one that's vague and overgeneralized, but a specific course to solve real problems in a creative way. And we haven't even gotten into, you know, the environmental issue, which is a thorny one, but one that the city is, you know, drafting legislation around that, you know, without detail, which again, I'm not sure we need to go there in this pod, but it's going to be difficult to satisfy the private investment community, you know, without some type of consideration, right? Without some type of phase in, right? It can't all happen at once. And, you know, again, the building stock is old and not terribly sustainable. So we'll see.
Right. I just really hope like there is more of like the solutions or agenda being discussed by many, many stakeholders, including the developers and the community and the technical experts who are going to help us get there and make it feasible. And I think it's really, and you know, we're in one of the most like diverse and multidisciplinary cities too. So I really hope to see more and more of that within the built environment as well, where we're trying to make like collaborative solutions to the problems we face. And I guess like on that too, like as a person who is sort of like being mindful of delivering the right product, while still being able to meet investors' need or meet the regulations, it's very challenging, but you're still doing it, right? So what would be your advice to others who are trying to push a little bit harder to make sure they are actually trying to contribute to a sustainably better future?
I think the most important thing is just don't get stuck in neutral. Just be as thoughtful as you possibly can be about the problem, right? Identify the problem. And then let's come up with ideas, right? It can be a little problem. It can be a big problem. I think you want to stay away from the enormous problems that become more philosophical. Like, you know, we all want a richer world. We all want a more equal world, a more peaceful world. We want the world to be more efficient, less corrupt, right? All of these things are great, but they're just words, right? We've seen efforts along those lines, even some results, but for the most part, you know, you run into unforeseen problems and you end up stuck in, as I said, neutral. And so I always just like to say, you know what, engage people in your problem solving process. You know, we have weekly meetings internally. They can be very little issues. You know, a tenant's dealing with, you know, a lack of heat or the radiator's making noise. They can be big problems. You know, the city's, you know, asking us to do this and, you know, it for whatever reason is a difficult thing for us to be able to do. So I think we're relying on not just ourselves and our internal kind of knowledge and experience, but we're also surrounding ourselves, whether it's with, you know, architects, expediters, you know, lawyers. It could be someone that's completely unrelated to this industry or sector, but we're very thoughtful about our shortcomings, what we know, of course, what we don't know. And we are trying to include more people than less in the problem solving. And I think generally that's helpful to the extent that, again, you don't end up with too many opinions that then handicap your decision to be, you know, productive.
Yeah, I love that. You're only as good as a team and just recognize that, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know what? We've kept our team relatively small intentionally, right? We want a culture that's built on collaboration and, we want to manage projects, not people. and we want to make sure that our projects are, you know, kind of tailored to the individual neighborhood and to the community as kind of best they can. And it's hard to scale. I mean, we certainly can grow and we want to grow, and we are growing, but it's with a high degree of thought, because we want to do it the right way.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And thank you so much, Aaron.
No, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Tune in next week when we sit down with Nick Tidball, co-founder of Volabek. Volabek uses science and technology to create clothing of the future. Since their launch 4 years ago, they have won innovation awards from Time and Fast Company and have been compared to Tesla and Elbowly for their radical commitment to what comes next. For more information on our events and podcasts, visit us at whatswrongwith.xyz.